Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And thank you for joining us on this Sunday night on ABC Local Radio, through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. And it's good to have back into the studio somebody who's it's been on a bit of a journey.
I most certainly have, John. I've been in Rome and all over Australia. I was in Rome during the papal election, so it's nice to be back home and back with you.
I've got to say, before we start this discussion, we're going to be talking about some difficult stuff. I want to get to mea maxima culpa shortly, but you've come out of an atmosphere. Let's just get a little of the atmosphere of Rome.
It was an extraordinary time to be in Rome. I was there as a visiting professor at the Jesuits Gregorian University and to teach a communications course. And it just so happened that just before I left to go and take up that position, the Pope resigned, and I was teaching a semester in 3.5 weeks. So I happened to hit Rome while the conclave was on and the election and immediately after. And I'd have to say it is the most extraordinary time to be in Rome. I had an atheist friend of mine whom I found on the night that the Pope came out onto the balcony. I said to him, "You're not a believer." And he said, "I believe in all of this because of the theatre of it and the drama of it." And it was just the most wonderful time to be there. And then that a Jesuit came out on the balcony was, well, that was as big a shock to me as a Jesuit as it was to the rest of the church, I think.
If for people who aren't aware of this, the Jesuits have historically seen themselves as part of, but slightly separate from, in the sense of loyalty to the Pope, but not actually aspiring to be Pope. And so you've had this tradition of the black Pope, the Jesuit general standing there to one side as a sort of Praetorian guard.
I'm not sure we quite like thinking of ourselves as separate from the church in any way, but we do, it is true, we take a vow of obedience to the Pope in mission. So now we have a Jesuit who, in a sense, once took a vow to the office that he now holds, which, anyway, that ends up being an interesting idea for 5 minutes, because once you become a bishop, you formally leave the Society of Jesus, so because you're not subject to the authority of the Jesuits anymore.
Let's talk about some of the movies we've got, Confraticus, and these are dealing with great questions. Some see it in a rather superficial way, but nevertheless, films that do tease at larger questions. Oblivion. Tom Cruise as the beginning to age astronaut, world weary.
Yes, I went to this film not with very high expectations, I think, because I just thought I've probably seen it before, and I think I have seen it before. At one level, it's just derivative action, science, fantasy, terrific ride. It feels like a ride. You strap yourself in and go for the ride. And it's good fun. But at another level, and it is actually asking quite profound questions. And it takes itself a lot more seriously because of what we call in cinema studies intertextuality, that it uses all sorts of other texts that are introduced in a very serious way for our purposes tonight. I think the issue of what does it mean to be a human being? What constitutes a soul? What importance is memory? Like, we could get on to these later, but for the moment, honestly, I wasn't expecting that. And they're as old as theology. They're as old as the Bible.
And a number of the critics have said, these are old questions in sci-fi. They've been raised many, many times, and it's warmed over, but warmed over brilliantly.
Yes, I think you go and see this film for lots of reasons. The first is simply for the CGI. The computer-generated images are absolutely outstanding. The art direction, the sets, the costumes, all of it is just beautifully done. Secondly, there are just hilarious things in it. Like, for instance, and spoiler alert for all of our friends right now who are going to be cranky with me, but I don't know how to get around it. It's that sort of film. But there's a nuclear catastrophe that has done over the Earth and killed most of humanity. And Tom Cruise now has to sort of save the day. It's much more complex than all of this will do, but it'll do for the moment. But this nuclear war did over New York City, but the books of the New York Public Library somehow stayed intact. Now, I don't know much about nuclear catastrophe, but I think fire and warmth and energy probably won't see too many libraries surviving.
And the book is critical.
And the book's absolutely critical, and it's one of the great moments in the film, because the book's Thomas Babington Macaulay's Horatius, the Lays of Ancient Rome, which we get that very
Horatius
famous
and the bridge.
Quote. Yes, we get that very famous quote about facing down fearful odds for the ashes of his fathers and the temples of his god. What better way for a man to die? And that's exactly what Tom goes on to do. Yes. That's the other problem with the film, is, at least from my point of view, I got horribly confused. And in reading lots of my film critic colleagues, I wasn't the only one. I think the film got a little lost somewhere in the third act. And it's certainly a three-act structure. But in the third act, it wasn't quite sure how to resolve the problem of who is, in fact, in the TET, this big thing that's sucking up all this energy from the Earth. Who's actually there?
And, see, that was not a problem for me, because I'd read sci-fi, and there are books like one of John Wyndham's early books, written under the pseudonym John Bennion, a book called The Sleepers of Mars, is a meditation on non-carbon life forms and whether or not, if you go to a silicon-based life form. So I didn't have to struggle with what is the nature of that ultimate thing out there.
Ted started to worry me, because I was confused then about who was on board and why they needed Earth's water. that I got lost there. But by that stage, I was enjoying so many other things in it, and I was fascinated by the serious topics they picked up, that it really held me all the way to the end. And I wouldn't normally be a science fantasy person, I have to say. I've got to be convinced of it. There's only so much suspense of disbelief that can go on for me. That said, it did play. It's the number one film at the box office in a week. It's taken $3.2 million in a week. Many of our compatriots love this stuff and can't get enough of it. And an important thing to note for some of our listeners right now is, regularly people like saying only sex and violence sells at the cinema. Well, it's actually not true, and it hasn't been true for about 25 or 30 years. There are two big things at the Australian box office almost every year, animation comedies and science fantasies. And here is one of the biggest science fantasies we're going to have this year. That said, none of us are idiots. We know that sex and violence does sell, but it sells for a very particular demographic. It sells for 13 to 25-year-old males. Now, that comes as a shock to any of us who were ever male and 19 once, that sex and violence is something we're terribly interested in.
There's enough of that in there for those to keep that demographic happy. But as you say, it teases at other questions.
It does. And it does it, I think, in a way that is actually a bit fresh for this genre. And quite directly, the Morgan Freeman character, who's head of the resistance group of humans on the Earth struggling to recover, it's got all this. He's part of this whole kick for nostalgia of going back to another day. But then, of course, the issue becomes about the recovery of memory, and that somehow memory and humanity are deeply linked. And in this regard, I think it's absolutely on the money. I have to say, because in a book I wrote called Where the Hell is God, I had a go at trying to posit or think about theologically what constitutes a soul or a spirit. Like we say, our soul or spirit goes on to live with God. Well, we know that that's not our physical being. It's not our necessarily our emotional being. What could it be? And while it's inadequate, I guess, any words we put around this, it's always much more than what we can say. It is, nonetheless, I'm absolutely convinced, obviously, our memories must survive us, because this plugs into a very important element in the Old and New Testaments, but especially the Old, about God remembering, God knowing, that we will know God, God will know us, our sins will be remembered or not be remembered.
Or even if you're a secularist, your memory survives, you survive in the memory of others.
Yes, and when you go even to secular funerals, as there are many now, then, you know, what's that all about? It's a celebration of memory. Mm. Now, obviously, and that's fairly self-evident, but memories matter, and they've constituted something of who we are as a person.
Let's talk finally about some of the referential, deliberately referential stuff in this. You have the American idyll represented by that oasis in this wasteland, which is pure Americana. It's the Americana of the great landscapes of the 19th century. 19th century. There, it's just this little pocket.
It's extraordinary. That seems to be within an hour of the nuclear-wasted New York City. Again, it's one of the great, the lovely things you just smile about. And when you get there, it's a Garden of Eden. But curiously, it's a Garden of Eden, well, not quite in reverse, but there is a whole reworking of the Garden of Eden narrative here, because Jack has to take on not Hal, as in A Space Odyssey. This time it's Sal or Sally, and return to the garden. So not getting cast out of the garden, but returning to it where there's an innocence. The Lilith narrative could be there too, because there are two women here, and he has to reject one and be with the other. There's then the repopulation or regeneration of the earth in this. And incredibly, they keep accompanying all of these scenes in this idyllic valley, living like Thoreau, into the woods, back to the nostalgia of an age we've now lost. Then we start playing Led Zeppelin and
A Whiter Shade of Pale
from 1960. So this sort of, again, this these flower power, idyllic sort of period, we look back in with rose-coloured glasses, and that's what we apparently are trying to re-establish on Earth.
And right at the heart, or at the apogee of evil here, we return to 2001, because what confronts our hero at the end of the journey is the staring red mechanical or technological eye.
It's a homage. There's no question that this one keeps referencing all the time 2001 A Space Odyssey, and so the genre should. That film kicked off this entire genre as we now have it, and brought it mainstream, and adults and kids and everybody in between liked it, and we've embraced it ever since. One of the more interesting one, though, is I can't remember if White's Christina's World ever figured in the film, but certainly in Arthur C. Clarke's book, there's quite a significant reference made to that painting, and this is one of the recovered memories.
Of course,
one of the things that it's hard to describe the painting. It's a woman who's looking longingly for home. We assume looking up the hill,
lost in a wheat field,
over a wheat field which is bare. So, you know, post-war. The other thing about, of course, is that Arthur C. Clarke film was made after a war. 1948 it was written. And so it evokes this trying to come home, trying to find another form of existence, another mode of being. So there are there's a sophistication and intelligence behind this stuff.
Even several banks of star children for one brief glimpse as he looks at those fetuses in the
That's true, yes. There are many, many references being made here, but 2001, Hal and Sal have got to be the most direct, and it's fun, and they're obviously having fun with it.
And a wonderful film to watch.
It is. Well, it's just a visually delight. But now with you know, the background we've given it, well, you can also see how multi-layered it actually is.
Let's move on to go from that sort of joyous celebration, in a way, of filmmaking at its best as entertainment and as a little provoking, to film in another genre, film that can take us to some dark places, but necessarily so. This is Mea Maxima Culpa, a documentary, Silence in the House of God. I read the Roger Ebert review. Roger Ebert, the great movie critic,
yes,
Chicago
just recently died.
Recently died, and his review on this, I've got to say, it was one of those that would stand separate in some ways, because he actually found he had a connection to the experience. So one of the bishops named in the film as having moved on. Priests and Ebert 30, who had no connection with this story at all, he found, hang on, this guy was my bishop.
Yes.
And that's, I guess, how many people are finding this whole abuse experience.
The connection to it. I would have thought that the Ebert review, which I've read as well, was very moving, because it had to be written in the last weeks of his life. Mm. This is a terribly confronting film. The only word you could use for this film is harrowing. But to all the Catholics who are listening to us right now, indeed all Christians who are with us right now, I think it's a film we have to go and see. This Royal Commission that's coming, and thank God it is, but this Royal Commission is now going to give a voice and a platform to victims' stories. And when you get confronted with the rawness of the pain and the tragedy of child sexual abuse at the hands of the clergy, or of anyone else, I assume, but with the clergy especially, it is just harrowing. The fact that these men who were abused were deaf, They were at St. John's School for the Deaf in the 50s and 60s, and at the hands of a serial and pathological pedophile, Father Lawrence Murphy, they're abused for decades, and some of them are many, many times over. And they weren't believed. So it's an, like mea maxima culpa, to have great sorrow for sin. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, for my sins, for my sins, for my many sins, or my great sins. But the next part of that title, I think, is a very important thing. Silence in the house of God, because the people we're dealing with here are deaf. They're hearing impaired. And they weren't believed.
And, of course, the church was silent.
The church was silent. So it's a play on the word, but they weren't believed because of their disability. Their own parents wouldn't believe them, and the church officials questioned whether their claims had any veracity because of their disability. So it's one of those few films I've ever been to where there might have been 50 or 60 people at the screening I saw, where you can audibly hear people calling out and saying things and gasping in the cinema. And there aren't many films that evoke that sort of response from an Australian audience, but this is one of them. And I think even though it's harrowing beyond belief, and most people want to go to the cinema for escapism, and this is anything but, I think in this day and age, many of us need to line up to this, because it starts to give voice to what a Royal Commission is going to be looking at for the sake of the whole good of the whole community.
There have been a couple of other films in this line. Several years ago, there was the Magdalen Laundries film, which showed the sort of harrowing experience that many young women were subject to. Last year, or it was maybe the year before, there was another film on sex abuse, child sex abuse, that tended to sort of heighten, and it's been criticised by some as being as basically pulling together a series of stories and making them one, but just overplaying its hand a bit, trying to push the outrage. That hasn't been the case here. The response from the critical community is, if anything, it's the outrage is produced in you. It's not drawn out of you by the filmmaker.
No, I think there's something about the having the sign language, Auslang, used in the film, which means that it draws you into the story of these men who are abused, and their faces are so evocative and their hands are so powerful, although there's a voiceover telling their story, interpreting their sign, their language, for the sake of a hearing audience. I found that incredibly compelling. I think it was the only one that's similar that I've seen is Deliver Us From Evil, which I think was 2006, yeah. But I think came here in about 2009, which was the story of the Irish priest who was moved around California and abused many people and went back to Ireland and abused all over again. And it really ends up being the study of pathology and of a complete inability to firstly understand the pathology and secondly what to do about it. And, of course, this not only touches church life, it touches family life, it touches social institutions. Now, that's not in any way, shape or form to deflect from the seriousness of this for the church. It's just saying it's widespread, it's right across. I certainly read a figure that, you know, so 83% of all sexual abuse of children, I think this was in the John Jay report in the United States. In the United States, 83% of all child sexual abuse occurs in the family home with a person known to the family. Now, there's a pathology right well beyond social or religious institutions. So getting a handle on it, what to do about it, and God knows this film, and I use the word God knows very deliberately in this case, the Vatican local authorities did not know what to do. And even though it was criminal behaviour, then, of course, they were opting, as we now know, appallingly so, criminally so, they're opting for the so-called good name of the church over the rights and the responsibilities they have towards victims.
Let's end where we began, in Rome. It's one of the major issues Pope Francis is going to face. And you've seen in the last week or so, the Curia, Cardinal George Pell has been appointed to a group to look into the Curia, reform of the Curia, that will go to the way the church is administered. Has the message, in your understanding, got that far into the system?
Look, I don't know, but I hope so, because those of us who are priests in, who have a great empathy with victims and their families, those who are angry and disillusioned with this issue, really hope that people in Rome have heard this, because they need to. You only have to meet a victim and his or her family to see the devastation that this does, and that this was a person who got up in a pulpit and talked about God and peace and love and justice, and then their own pathology then was visiting the worst crimes. We just hope and pray that cardinals and bishops in Rome have heard that cry.
I say that because it seems to me that the central thrust of this film is to build layer upon layer upon layer and take it deeper and deeper and deeper into the hierarchy. It's almost saying you have to hear, not down at the grassroots just, but up in the hierarchy.
Well, when I was in Rome, the one thing in the days before the conclave that was regularly said, and in fact I think it might have been said even by Cardinal Pell, was to describe the Roman Curia as dysfunctional. And it wasn't just about Vatty leaks, and it wasn't just about the Vatican Bank, as scandalous as they are, all of that is, but it was also talking about the dysfunction of the internal governance. The whole thing needs overhauling. This film brilliantly portrays, I think, a personal dysfunction, a local dysfunction, an institutional dysfunction, and then all the way up to a governance dysfunction, that people won't be believed, they want to protect their so-called good name, and they keep wanting to listen to the story that they would prefer to believe, one rather than the one that is. Now, if Pope Francis has any major job to do, I think for all Catholics of goodwill, it is to utterly clean this up, root and branch. And I would think nothing is more important than that for the credibility of the church, because right at the moment, the Catholic Church's credibility, no matter what good it does every single day, and it does a lot of good in Australia every single day, every ounce of good is understandably is undermined by the child sexual abuse by clergy issue, and we need to be able to confront that. So he's got a big job, but he's not on his own. We've got to confront it too, and every family might have to look into its own heart and soul as well. So once we start on this journey through this Royal Commission, while it's looking at institutional abuse and responses, it's going to have an implication for family life as well, if we're going to be honest about talking about the issue right across the board.
Richard Leonard, great to have you as always on Sunday Night.
Thank you, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.